Models of management. That's a sticky issue as we consider Mauna Kea and the standoff on the mountain. HBR's Ku'uwehi Reishi is here to talk about that. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. That's right. So last week, the University of Hawaii's Board of Regents considered a resolution, and it had 12 items. In this resolution, of course, non-binding, so, you know, folks were a little worried about whether we can hold the Board of Regents accountable for what's in this. But one element that was interesting is a request or a call for an in-depth analysis to be done on whether the management of Mauna Kea would be better served if transferred to another authority, a government authority, or perhaps a third party. So we went out to look at some of these models, and the first that came to my mind, mostly because of sort of the related activism, is Ko'olawe and the Ko'olawe Island Reserve Commission. So for those who might not know the entire history there, back in 1941, right after Pearl Harbor, the attack on Pearl Harbor, the United States had declared martial law here in Hawaii and actually went, the U.S. Navy went to Ko'olawe, kicked the ranchers off, and began training. For World War II, Ko'olawe became the premier spot for military training in and around the Pacific during World War II. But fast forward to the 1970s, a protest by Native Hawaiians and a group called Protect Ko'olawe Ohana would, I think, last maybe two decades until 1990, when the U.S. Had actually stopped bombing, and the island was returned to the state in 1994 officially. And so right now, the Ko'olawe Island Reserve Commission, a very autonomous body, includes members from, or seats on this commission are offered to folks from Protect Ko'olawe Ohana, and then also several other state agencies, BLNR, County of Maui's on there, Office of Hawaiian Affairs has a seat, and then an open seat for another Native Hawaiian organization. So we were looking for models that sort of broadened the role of Native Hawaiians in this management of this island. I got to speak to Mike Nahopi, who's the head executive director of the commission, and he says the autonomy, because of this, it's a state model, right? So a lot of what they do, they can easily get done because they don't have to go through the hoops of having to go through the Department of Health to get this permit, or County of Maui, because every stakeholder is on this commission.
Right, so they're all sitting at the table.
Exactly, and it is a state-funded model right now. And it's interesting because the focus is restoration-based. So when it comes to Mauna Kea, there's a science and the astronomy involved in there. So this doesn't entirely address that, but Noho'opi'i kind of had explained that at the beginning, or at the originating point of their mission, it is to sort of restore the natural resources, but also the cultural practices. So here's Noho'opi'i to explain that.
There's a long history of cultural practices on Ko'olawe, because that's one of the main reasons Ko'olawe was established, was so that Native Hawaiians had a place that they could go and have cultural as a priority, Native Hawaiian traditional cultural practices. So as a reserve, we are set aside for that as a priority versus native plants or fish. So, so we're protecting the fish, but we're protecting the fish so that when people want to come and do traditional fishing methods, there's actually fish there, you know.
So a lot of autonomy, I think, is a good way of sort of painting this state model. But we also went to look at a partnership model. So Native Hawaiian organizations, mainly Office of Hawaiian Affairs and the federal and state governments, work on the Papahana Mokua Kea National Marine Monument, right? So this massive land-to-sea management model. We spoke to Atheline Clark, who's the monument superintendent for NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association. And she mentions this permitting system where really this entity is able to balance, or strives to balance, scientific research and cultural significance. And that's something that perhaps we can weave into any sort of future model up on Mauna Kea. But here's Clark explaining how the permitting system works.
We set up a joint permitting system, and we agreed that every permit, even if it was a research permit, had to also go through and have a cultural lens on it. It has to be why there and not elsewhere. Whatever the activity is has to provide a value for the place. And we put a value for the culture.
And that works vice versa as well. Any cultural access or permit requests, what's considered in that process is also the biological impacts, right? What's going to happen to the natural resources if we grant this cultural access? So it was an interesting element of Papahanaumokuʻa Kea's model. And the last model we looked at was more of a community-based approach. So an example would be the Haʻena community-based subsistence fishing area over on Kauai and Moʻomomia Molokaʻi in the works. But the community had gotten together and came up with a list of rules on how they want the resources and the fishing resources in their community to be managed. How can others come in and fish? So, for example, and I'll give you one small example, spearfishing is not allowed at night in those waters. And the idea is that the community wanted that. And they think it will have an impact on sort of replenishing fishing stocks. Overfishing is a problem here across the state. And so Kevin Chang, co-director at Kua Aina Ulu Awamo, or Kua, and they work with these communities to help come up with the rules and put them through this process. He explains sort of the importance of this community-based approach versus a state model or perhaps a government partnership with Native Hawaiian organizations.
We use the words like indigenous and local knowledge, situated knowledge, how certain knowledge and ability to respond and manage a situation is best located on the ground in the local place where the people most dependent on the resources are. And it's important in our current age because of things around climate change and ability to build resilient communities. It's important for communities to be able to continue. I'm not saying like this is a new thing, but to continue to be better at taking care of each other and their environment.
Right. So this community-based model, what Chang had mentioned, though, one sort of not downfall, but a weakness, if you were a challenge for these models, is the enforcement aspect
right.
of it.
Who's policing.
Right. Exactly. And so that is a sort of a challenge for that model. And I think for the Native Hawaiian and government partnership model of Papahanaumokuʻa Kea, part of the challenge is sort of the bureaucracy of red tape, because you need buy-in from all these stakeholders, various jurisdictions, various interests. And then the state model, like we had mentioned earlier, great autonomy. But the mission is pretty, everyone's clear on what they're trying to do there. And it is to sort of hold that island in trust for a future Native Hawaiian governing entity. One element that I noticed throughout these models, and speaking with Greg Chun, so head of Mauna Kea stewardship over at the University of Hawaii, he said, we really need to ask, is with Mauna Kea, is it a science reserve that just so happens to be one of the most culturally significant areas in Hawaii, or is it a culturally significant area that just so happens to be the top spot for astronomy? And once we answer that question and figure out that originating point, can figure out where to go next.
So as far as the resolution that the Board of Regents took, then?
Timeline-wise, April 2020 is actually the date in there, but it is a reso, as we mentioned earlier, non-binding. But in the resolution, it asks for a restructuring plan to be presented to the board in April of next year, and it should include in there an in-depth analysis of whether any of these models could work.
All right. Okay. Thanks so much, Kuʻuvehi.
Yeah.
That was HPR's Kuʻuvehi Hiraishi with a snapshot of possible models of managing Mauna Kea. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org.